It's Monday, July 12th. It's a disgrace when Americans can't get enough food. So what is it when our largest state doesn't have enough water? We start here. Amid a worsening drought and soaring temperatures, Californians are asked to conserve.
Those reservoirs and storage facilities are only going to get lower as far as the water is concerned.
Weather systems pass, but their effects are slowly, steadily getting worse. Officials say they figured out how an assassination squad was assembled.
Who is in charge here in Haiti?
I don't know if there is a power struggle.
Our team has spoken to the man claiming to be in charge of Haiti. The problem is, he's not the only one. And you thought ballot drop boxes were controversial? What about online voting?
There's just no technical way to have a secure, private online ballot.
This is already happening in several states. So in an era of work from home, who should have the right to vote from home? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Oh my gosh, it feels like an oven. Like you could just bake the tons of eggs all over everything.
In recent months, the western part of the United States has been dry, cloudless, and incredibly, unbearingly hot.
This seems to be the hottest summer it's ever been. So it's retreat.
I want to show you the numbers. The hottest days ever in Portland. We've hit 107 degrees three times. Well, guess what we just did?
These are not the kind of events that make you go, yeah, we're used to extreme weather. We're tough. No, this is the type of weather that affects livelihoods and affects lives.
Some haven't been discovered yet. At least 116 others have and have been confirmed by the state as dying because of the heat.
When it gets abnormally hot, state and local governments do have emergency levers they can pull. Well, this weekend, the governor of California pulled one of them.
Turning up your air conditioner could put more stress on our electrical grid to leave many of us without power. The flex alert has now been extended in the hopes that that won't happen.
Gavin Newsom told Californians that while temperatures remain this high, they need to use less electricity to prevent an overload of the grid, which you'd expect to be a temporary thing, right? Just while everyone's ACs are on, please do your part. But he also begged Californians to use less water.
We're hopeful that people will take that mindset that we brought into. People of the state of California will take that mindset they brought into the last drought and extend that forward with a 15% voluntary reduction.
The concern here is that these conditions are not going back to normal.
It has to be a new way of life.
They've got to start. Everybody's got to start now.
Everybody's got to start now.
This weekend seemed to suggest that whatever you thought was normal or abnormal, that might have changed. Let's start the day with ABC senior meteorologist Rob Marciano. And Rob, can you just put in perspective how dire the situation has become in the West Coast and specifically in California?
Well, we've had a multi-year drought in California, Brad, but this is within that realm. And what makes this one different from the ones we've seen in the past few years is that last year was a pretty good year.
The governor declaring a state of emergency in 50 of 58 counties.
For instance, 85% of California right now is in extreme drought. A year ago, that number was only 2%.
Utah's drought situation is worsening. Reservoir levels continue to drop across the state.
And similar figures for Utah and Nevada. So this thing just came on with a vengeance after a pretty dry spring and a very, very, very warm start to the summer. As you mentioned, three heat waves. And what's different about these three heat waves is not only how widespread they are.
29 million people are under heat alerts tonight.
How long a duration they are and how early they are.
Temperatures in Las Vegas this weekend soaring to 117 degrees, the highest ever recorded there.
But every single one of them was an event where all-time record highs were threatened or broken, and that, quite frankly, is frightening.
Hey, what changed then from like a week ago or 2 weeks ago? You mentioned there have been multiple heat waves. Why was this the moment that somebody like Gavin Newsom decides, hey, yeah, let's pull that trigger. Let's ask people to reduce water consumption.
Well, every time temperatures go above normal, especially in the West where humidity is low, you're just baking the dirt.
You know, typically with the full reservoir, we'd be under 32 feet of water right now.
And you're evaporating water from the streams, the reservoirs, what little snowpack is left.
Our historical average is about 19 inches of precipitation in this region.
Uh-huh.
This water year, we've only received about 4.5 inches.
And that's the water that we irrigate from. That's the water that we use to bathe and drink. And that's the water that Californians especially need to space out over the course of the summer and fall before the rainy season hits, really not until November and December of next year. So with no more rain coming, no significant rain at least, in the next several months, those reservoirs and storage facilities are only going to get lower as far as the water is concerned. So you've got to start conserving now. It's a crude wake-up call.
But do those restrictions, when a governor says, hey, 15% less water, do those work? Because I feel like it would be easy for a resident to be like, wait, there's so much waste in the system. You got huge companies, huge manufacturers, farms using electricity and water by the boatload. My shower is the thing that has to go? Like, my dishwasher is actually the problem? That's going to make a difference?
Well, every little bit helps. And the other thing with this is that these particular restrictions are voluntary.
We are encouraging people to do the common sense things, like reducing the amount of irrigation in the water you're doing out on your lawns, for example, reducing perhaps the time that you are in a shower. I'm not
but I think what he's trying to do is basically wake everybody up and say,
we have conservation as a way of life.
You know, start now, because you're going to have to get used to this as we get deeper into the summer. Mandatory restrictions are going to get in place, and you're just going to have live life differently.
Tonight, wildfires exploding in the West, fueled by life-threatening heat in that mega drought that's drained water resources across the region.
This is definitely a strong link to climate change. You can talk about other weather events, flash floods, severe weather, hurricanes, and you can question some of those events and their link to climate change, but heat, drought, it's simple physics. You pump more carbon into the atmosphere. That's a greenhouse gas. It's going to warm the global temperatures as a whole, and you're going to have a likelihood to see more heat waves.
And keep in mind that June was the hottest June on record ever for the United States this year.
It checks all the boxes, unfortunately, and this has a strong link to climate change.
Right. There are already reports of Californian towns that have already run out of water. Some of them that run on well systems, it's gone. So they're desperately asking other counties, other states to just lend them some water. Rob Marciano, thanks so much.
You got it, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, he was named the next prime minister of Haiti, but the man who named him was assassinated. A power struggle has begun after the break.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Ever since Haiti's president was shot dead by what appeared to be a brutal, carefully planned assassination, there have been two major questions. The first is, who did this? Was this a group of criminals, mercenaries? Was this a plot to remove a man who had held on to power despite a murky constitutional situation? Which leads to the second question. If Haiti was already in murky constitutional waters, who's in charge now? There have now been new answers to both of these questions, but that doesn't mean either of them are necessarily settled. Let's go to ABC's Marcus Moore, who has made his way to the capital of Haiti. He's in Port-au-Prince right now. Marcus, what have we learned about this bizarre killing?
Well, hey, Brad, to borrow the phrase, the cliche, the plot thickens, and this plot has been thickening every single day since this assassination. And so yesterday, the top police official in the country here in Haiti, he came out and he said that, quote, we've identified one of the masterminds of this plot. And he went on to explain how it worked.
17 suspects are in custody this morning, and among them, two Americans.
You know, through our reporting, that a number of Colombian nationals have been arrested in connection with the assassination.
How can you be sure that you have the right people?
We do have the right people. They are all Colombians.
And the police chief named a Haitian national, Christian Emmanuel Sanon, who he's accused of playing a key role in the planning of this attack.
Christian Emmanuel Sanon, qui maintenant sous contrôle la police.
According to the police chief, Sanon hired the Colombian nationals through a U.S.-based security firm under the pretext that they would work as his security detail and provide security for his business. Now, this security company that was contacted by Sanon is a Venezuelan company that's based in the U.S. And in early June, the police chief said Sanon arrived in Haiti accompanied by the suspects on a private plane. And the mission that Sanon had initially given them, according to the police chief, was that they would ensure the safety of his business and himself. But then according to Chief Leon Charles, according to him, the mission changed. And he said that Emmanuel presented one of the suspects with a warrant for the arrest of the president, Jovenel Moise. And then that person informed the rest of the group about that mandate and for them to carry out the president's arrest. And so, according to the head of the police force here, it was at that moment that the operation to kill the president had started. But what's key here, Brad, is that the chief, he didn't provide any more detail outside of that.
The worry in almost any country after the leader of a country dies is going to be like, who's next up, right? Is the order of succession rock solid? Will there be a power struggle? And if there is, would that turn into something troublesome or even violent? I mean, you spoke to the man who's been described as running Haiti right now, right? But he's not necessarily the only one claiming he's in charge.
No, he's not. In fact, he was on his way out, and another man had actually been appointed by President Moise. His name is Dr. Ariel Henry, and he had actually been appointed the day before the assassination happened, but he had not yet been sworn in.
Well, Claude Joseph was the incumbent in the position. He was serving as the acting prime minister before the assassination of President Moise. We continue to work with Claude Joseph as such.
You have the current acting prime minister who was effectively done with his role, and the incoming prime minister who had been chosen, but he's not, based on the Constitution, has not been sworn in. And so, you know, you don't have a president. You also don't have a full Senate. And so you're stuck with the situation that we're in right now, where you have multiple people who are saying they should lead the country.
Is there a power struggle going on right now? Who is in charge here in Haiti?
I don't know if there is a power struggle. I'm not paying attention to whether or not there's a power struggle.
When I spoke with the acting prime minister, Claude Joseph, he said that he is in charge right now.
I was a prime minister at interim, I should say. So after the tragic death of President Jovenel Moise, I had to take charge, and I did.
And that he will make the way for an election to come in September, but for all intents and purposes, in the midst of this crisis, he is running the country.
My only and ultimate goal is to give justice to President Jovenel Moise.
His main focus right now is keeping people calm and also trying to find justice for the people who killed the president.
Right. I was going to say the keeping people calm thing is the issue when you talk about multiple people saying, hey, we've got it from here. Are people keeping calm, Marcus? I mean, we spoke to someone last week who basically said there are people taking the law into their own hands at points. What are you seeing?
So what I have seen, Brad, is that people are they're shocked.
Moi-même tout sécurité m'a dangé tout.
It made me feel like, for me, comparatively speaking, as a regular normal citizen walking down the street, my life is in danger too.
This is a country that for decades has been in the midst of political turmoil. So that is nothing new. But here we are, where the president has been assassinated, and you have multiple people wanting to be the leader, and then you have everyday people on the streets just struggling to survive.
Desperate scenes, shortages of food and fuel, people lining up when they hear about a station with gas, using any kind of container they can find to haul it away.
When this happened, the officials declared a state of siege and basically locked the country down. And that left people to stay in their homes, and that left people without an opportunity, no place to work. And if they did try to work, there was nobody out on the streets to buy anything.
What has life been like here in Port-au-Prince since Wednesday?
The economic toll of this is what we have seen.
Life has been very hard. Since Wednesday up until today, I haven't made a dime.
I met a number of people who said that they really don't have hope at this point. They said, what is there to hope for?
All right, Marcus Moore there in Haiti. Thank you so much for the time, Marcus.
Thank you, Brad. Always good to be with you.
This weekend in Texas, the state legislature was reconvened for a special session. You might remember a few weeks ago, the final vote of that session had to be scrapped as Democrats literally fled the building without telling anyone to avoid a quorum or a vote on a new voting security bill.
SB 7, for example, would limit extended early voting hours, prohibit drive-through voting, allow the recording of voters who need help with their ballots, and ban officials from encouraging voters to fill out mail-in ballot applications.
Well, at the Republican governor's orders, lawmakers are back. And while Democrats are not expected to be able to hold out this long, they did say they extracted some key concessions from the GOP. Well, as some states clamp down on voting access, other states are insisting it needs to be opened up even further, to the point where some states are seriously considering allowing more widespread use of online voting. Kaylee Rogers is a reporter with our partners at 538. And Kaylee, I feel like this country can't agree on using ranked choice voting, like can't agree on ballot drop boxes, right? Is voting online a serious possibility?
Well, I mean, it's already the reality for a number of Americans, Americans who are overseas, who are serving in the military, and increasingly Americans with disabilities are actually able to receive and return their ballots online.
As you all may know, if you're active duty and stationed away from home, you can still vote.
There was an act in the 80s, the UOKAVA Act, to ensure that military and overseas voters were able to cast a ballot absentee. It was making, you know, guaranteeing their right to still cast a ballot even if they weren't at home on the day of the election.
It lets you register to vote and request an absentee ballot from your home state. Then your state will send you a ballot wherever you're stationed.
And later on, there were provisions added to make sure that, you know, if you're on a Navy vessel and you can't get to a mailbox to receive your ballot, you should be able to receive it electronically, a blank ballot that you then print off, fill out, and return the physical ballot. That's all that the federal provisions stipulate. But at the state level, some states started to also allow for electronic return of ballots.
This is considered the soft opening to Florida's election season, and supervisors are able to track the ballots using a barcode that's on the envelope. Only the overseas residents will be able to cast their vote by fax.
And so that's through fax machines, sometimes through email or through these web portals sometimes. So that was starting to happen at the state level in the early 2000s. And it's expanded since then. And then more recently, some groups representing voters with disabilities have said, well, you know, this would be really helpful for many of our voters. It's already available to military and overseas voters.
Here in North Carolina, the State Board of Elections is providing a new voting portal for the visually impaired.
And in fact, there was a lawsuit in North Carolina saying essentially that, and the judge agreed, you can't have this available for one group and not another when some of those voters might be disenfranchised by not being able to access this technology. And so it's been expanded in a number of states. But what that means is there's a growing number of voters that are casting their ballots online. And the more numbers that are using it, the bigger the risk is.
Yeah, let's talk about the risks here, because you talked to several voting security experts about this, right? What are the concerns?
You know, from a security standpoint, there's just no technical way to have a secure private online ballot and know for a fact that the ballot the voter sends is the ballot that the election office receives.
They're military overseas. There's a way they can fax it, goes through a secure network and then comes to us. And then we have to duplicate that ballot because it's not a real ballot. You know, it's just a picture.
There's a number of ways that this could go wrong with the systems that are in place. So you can imagine even, you know, locally, if somebody had some malware on their computer, it could change it so that it looks to them like the vote that they want to cast is what's being recorded while secretly sending a different ballot across to the voting precinct. But then as well, yeah, I mean, there's privacy issues.
We have to protect voters' computers against everyday security problems like malware and problems with passwords and phishing.
You know, if there was a hacker that attacked a database or was able to attack the system and change all the votes or even just prove that they were able to get in, that could be enough to disrupt trust in the election, which is obviously something that we're seeing right now is a big issue in this country. So unfortunately, there's no way to do this securely and privately using the internet at this point in time.
But so, because I would normally be ending this by being like, well, you know, it would be nice and convenient to use online voting, but oh well, I guess it's just not ready for prime time yet. Except you're saying this is not some far-fetched idea for some other day. You're saying this is already happening, that more states are actively considering it, right? So if it's not ready for prime time, prime time's now. Is that not dangerous territory?
The consensus from the election security community is that this is a dangerous path to be going down, and really we should be rolling back access to this, except for exceptional circumstances. So
today we might say we get some defense, even though it's not perfect, by making sure our voting machines aren't plugged into the internet directly. Well, if you're voting online, you necessarily have to have your voting system plugged into the internet. It's almost as if you're painting a target on it.
It's a really tense conversation, right? Because we're talking about two really important prongs of democracy, having access to a vote and having a secure ballot. So those things are unfortunately often in opposition, where if you make it super accessible, if we could all vote, you know, via a Facebook poll, that's really easy, but it's not secure at all. And on the flip side, if it was very secure, you have to give your fingerprints and all these other things, that wouldn't be very accessible to anybody. So we're always trying to strike that balance. And this is an area where that really comes into sharp focus, because you have voters who already face a number of barriers to casting a ballot.
Some even having to give up their privacy to have someone help them fill out their ballots.
What would happen if you tried to hold a pen?
I would probably drop it.
And this is one way that could maybe make that access a little easier for them. And so they're demanding that, you know, they should have the same rights as any other American to cast a private and secure ballot. Unfortunately, online, the security isn't really there.
Right, and that's the concern that so many politicians are trying to grapple with here. Although the concern is everyone always operating in good faith in these arguments, right? Like, do you really care about ballot security, or do you really care about ballot access, or are you just trying to win an election with your constituents? Kaylee Rogers from 538, thank you so much for walking us through this.
Yeah, no worries.
All right, we're going to step away once more, but we'll be back quicker than Richard Branson experienced weightlessness, and that's not that long. One Last Thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
We are armed for release. 20 seconds.
And one last thing. We know the phrase, put your money where your mouth is, but Richard Branson has tons of money. So yesterday, he put himself where his money is.
3, 2, 1, release, release, release.
Yeah, so they're weightless, and they've been told they can unstrap.
In a first-of-its-kind mission, the head of Virgin Galactic became the first of the so-called space barons to fly on one of his own company's crafts to the edge of space.
To all you kids down there, I was once a child with a dream, looking up to the stars. Now, I'm an adult in a spaceship.
Traveling three times faster than the speed of sound, the VSS Unity climbed 50 miles above the surface of the Earth, which, according to the U.S. government, is where the Earth's atmosphere ends and is the point at which you can call yourself an astronaut. That's a reason to be hyped about this, but there are plenty of reasons not to be. For one thing, critics say, Why does anyone care about getting to the edge of space? But congrats, you made it to an arbitrary point in the sky. Yeah, you can see the curvature of the Earth, but it's not even like there's zero gravity up there. In fact, the only reason Virgin's astronauts get to experience weightlessness for 5 whole minutes is because they're experiencing gravity at the same rate that the floor is dropping out from under them.
Bezos' Blue Origin space company is already firing shots on Twitter, comparing the two companies.
One of these haters seemed to be Virgin's chief rival, Blue Origin,
saying, "Its new Shepard flies farther than Virgin spaceship, 62 miles above the surface, past the Kármán line."
And devastatingly, they pointed out that they travel by rocket. Virgin shuttles just get launched by airplanes.
Branson had told GMA this wasn't a space race.
"Honestly, I don't think either of us see it that way. We're not really in direct competition."
But don't get too full of yourself, Blue Origin. Some of your own former executives say that Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos just looked silly compared to the other space baron, Elon Musk.
"Liftoff of the Falcon 9 and Crew Dragon. Go NASA, go SpaceX. Godspeed, Bob and Doug."
Unlike his competitors, Musk's company SpaceX has actually put people into orbit. It's got NASA contracts. While you're arguing over 50 miles in the sky versus 60, Elon's next stop is Mars. To be profitable, Virgin Galactic will have to do trips like Branson's for $250,000 a pop, hundreds of times a year, so this successful flight makes that more realistic. But the question over the commercial space industry is if space joyrides, to where sky blue meets black night, are truly the future. And this is why I don't get invited to parties. Like, I'm a space downer. Nobody likes a space downer. Whatever, we can all have our own party. Hit us up on Twitter at StartHereABC. We're also on Instagram. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.